because I came later.
Right, but this is the guy that you knew already.
Yeah, but I didn't know that.
Yeah.
But that would be the guy that, as a matter of fact, I gave him assignments and stuff, but that's a whole other story.
What year would that be? 54 this very
56
time?
56 was when I was working for John Graham and Company, so this would have been before that, because when I worked at John Graham and Company, the father was down in Portland, which was his hometown anyway, but he was the head of the architectural approval of the Lloyd Center. He was a resident. He was a resident on-job representative of the architect in Portland for Lloyd Center, and I would be giving him all kinds of data and stuff.
Right, but his father was reassigned to work in Seattle for a construction company. Is that the company that you were working with or for?
I'm not sure. It could be.
See, it's interesting.
He could have been working for another one before he started working for John Graham. I don't know.
John Graham was an architectural company, not a construction company, right?
That's right.
But he could be an architect on a construction for a construction site.
Yes.
Yeah. So what's interesting is that he was working with you, and he may have been living at the center.
I don't know, because I was living at 518 West Roy in the haunted house, and then by the time I got through that and got over to the center, the father may have left, but it doesn't, I don't know. I don't know where he was living. No, wait a minute. He was living in Portland. No, he was living in Portland.
So he went back to Portland probably by the time you see him at the center and say, hey, what are you doing here?
By the time I see him at John Graham's.
Yes. No.
He just comes in and out. From Portland.
Oh, okay. So maybe okay. So he's the one of the first people at the center. He takes the master bedroom. Which bedroom is that? Is that the one on the fourth floor?
Or? That's the one next. That's one, the one next to the screened porch on the second floor.
So that's the second. You know,
floor. The master bedroom, and then it had this screened porch.
Oh, yeah. There were five bedrooms and a large enclosed porch off the main bedroom. Okay.
Yeah.
And that was the second floor, right? That's what it says.
Yeah.
So it says, so he takes the master bedroom. Several college students want the two remaining rooms. Phyllis would take a small room on the second floor that had a fireplace. She wanted a place to write. Did you know she was a writer?
Who?
Phyllis Goodall.
Possibly. I knew her. She wasn't living there when I moved in. She was a nurse. She and another nurse established some kind of rest home, maybe even two of them.
Mm. So that was later.
Apparently, right after she left the center.
Okay, so she took a small room on the second floor that had a fireplace. She wanted a place to write. She said that the place reminded her of England, where she had grown up. I thought that I would take the space on the top floor. Do you think of Phyllis Goodall as English in her accent?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
She seemed like it.
I believe that it was necessary to have some sense of being removed. See, he always took the distant place in the building to live, just to hang out. See, this would allow me to keep... he took the space on the top floor. This would allow me to keep some distance from everyone. Now, the top floor, that's where the ballroom is, and that's where you remember him and Connie being there 2 years, 3 years later. So he was still up there on the top floor when you come in.
Yes, because I wasn't there very long before I took the acid. And when I took the acid, I came up there on that floor and talked to them, and they were kind of interested, and then they got more interested, and then they decided to have me call him and set up a session for them the next day.
Okay.
So, yeah, it was up on that floor.
That's going to be real interesting when we get into how they got acid.
Later, they moved down into the master bedroom, but...
Right, but...
At that time.
They
and
were
then
up
Doobie moved in up on that floor.
Right, but at that time when you're first there, they were up, still up on the top floor.
I think so.
Yeah.
And Connie, of course, had just moved in the time factor when I saw him at Reinhardt's, and Connie saw him and went home with him and stayed.
Right. Now, in light of what you just said about how they got, what you said about them taking acid, wait till you hear how they say they took the acid. Okay, that's going to be good. But so.
But I know.
Yes, yes. He wants to keep his distance from everyone. I believe that it was necessary to have some sense of being removed, and this was due perhaps to my need to keep myself, Robert, that part of me that I thought must be kept private, hidden away.
Including Connie.
Yeah, and he says, but Connie's not there yet, but he says, I was still very much in the closet, not free to be myself. I mean, this is in the McCarthy era, right? This is 54, 55. It's a fierce time in America, right?
Well, yeah, somewhat.
But so he's saying, he says in the closet, he doesn't say that in quotes, so I guess he means as a homosexual, right?
I mean, yes.
So he had to keep that hidden away. This was due perhaps to my need to keep myself, Robert, that's how he writes it, Robert, that part of me that I thought must be kept private, hidden away. Okay, the attendance was growing, and Sunday mornings we had to open up the doors between the large living room and the dining room that also was used as a library. The number in attendance was smaller on Sunday evenings, and the message was quite different as well. In the evenings, the talks were deeper, and the atmosphere was charged with a special stillness that one could feel. The walls of the main meeting room were lined with polished mahogany. You remember that?
Yep.
And there was an altar over the fireplace with vigil lights and a large bronze with the Sanskrit letter Om engraved on a lotus flower.
Mm-hmm.
That was still there 3 years later.
Oh, yeah.
A pin spotlight lit the area, and of course there were flowers and the scent of Indian incense. There were rose-tinted leaded glass windows that bathed the room in a soft light.
Mm-hmm.
If you sat there, it was easy to feel peaceful and quiet. People sitting in a room over a period of time create an atmosphere that lingers. That must bring back a whole thing for you.
Yep.
And make you feel nice when you think of it?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. I mean, you would, if you think back, if I didn't read you this, and like a week ago we thought back, does this intensify the feeling that you would have a week ago?
Oh, anyway? Yes. I'm doing the recall a bit very, very much. Like actually being there and smelling the smells and seeing the light and all the rest of it, all kind. In other words, not just a memory, but a recall in present time to that. That becomes present time to me.
Yes.
For the moment that I'm in it.
Yeah. Great. Okay. He says I continued to give readings, but was now stressing the need to rely on oneself in order to understand the human condition. So he was slightly schizophrenic here. My own interest in Krishnamurti began to overshadow my psychic life. It was giving me a clearer picture of how humans live, how we create our problems, and how the whole culture has imprisoned us with dead ideas and beliefs. This, in turn, started a process in me where I began to question my actions, thus creating a conflict within myself. I began to feel that the psychic readings were in question. What good did they do? People used them in the wrong way, to ensure their self-protection by wanting to know the future. They use them not to face the issues of their lives, but to avoid pitfalls and to cover the sources of their problems. For some, the psychic readings offered an escape. Others thought it helped them on their spiritual journey. We all want to be comforted in some way, and I felt a party to it. The writings of Krishnamurti had become the source of inspiration for my Sunday talks. Slowly I was becoming... Now, he said his Sunday talks were... Previous page, were smaller on the Sunday evening. The Sunday mornings, we had to open up the doors. There were a lot more people. In the evenings, the talks were deeper, and the atmosphere was charged with a special illness, special stillness that one could feel.
But did you stutter?
Yes, I stuttered. But the thing is that he's saying that the Sun. Well, he doesn't say. Maybe the evening talks. He just says Sunday talks. I'm assuming they're the morning, but let's say they're the evening. The writings of Krishnamurti had become the source of inspiration for my Sunday talks. Maybe both of them.
Yeah.
Slowly I was becoming proficient in the Krishnamurti lingo. I knew all the phrases and words inside out. What J.K., that's his initial for Krishnamurti, had done was to create a new language not based on the past explanations. He attempted to find a different form using new terms that were now part of the new psychology. he wanted to break away from the past and try to impart some new framework based on the old dead thoughts of what others had said. He gave it a freshness that sprang from his own understanding. So there was all that on Christian Murray. Then he says, the center was growing larger, and a new group of people was attracted to the talks, and Worcester had not shown up yet. He was working with...
He didn't say that. You just did that.
Yeah, I just did that.
I got you.
Hey, Worcester, the gnome Worcester had not shown up yet. All was calm. Okay, the center was growing larger, and a new group of people was attracted to the talks. The interest in my psychic work was diminishing, and I was myself losing interest in it. Now, you know that some of the people did want it to come back, right?
I'd hear them talking about it, and I didn't know what it was about. I think it was only 3 weeks after I got there that he did do that. So I don't have too much time factor there to relate to about how much people said.
Right.
Because I was just a dumb dodo not paying much attention in a new space,
right?
Preoccupied with my haunted house experience that I was recovering from.
Yeah, recovering Ghostbuster.
Yeah.
Okay, the interest in my psychic work was diminishing, and I was myself losing interest in it. Of course, in the beginning, it attracted attention and drew people from all over the Northwest. It was quite busy there, right?
Well, at one point, I don't know the full facts. Maybe he'll mention it in here. By the time we started the acid sessions, I heard that they had as many as 500 names on the mailing list, and that many of them were members of the Center of Integration. But I didn't see that many people at once. That just may have been accumulated over a period of time and was something to draw on, you know.
Right, you're saying you didn't see that many people? Is that what you're saying?
There was lots of people, but not. I didn't see 500 people.
Right, I see, yeah.
I'd see maybe 50 to 70 at a time, and then I think there was some kind of a party that extended like a picnic out into the lawn and et cetera, and there was lots more people. So, but at any rate, it was like probably about 70 people at a time max for a meeting.
Right. Now, in the room at one point, at one time, on one day, you mean 70 people?
Yeah.
So you'll see something he's going to say just coming up here relates to why we're talking about this, or why I'm mm-hmm. thinking about it. Okay, he says, of course, in the beginning, it attracted attention and drew people from all over the Northwest. I had not realized that the people who wanted assurance about themselves and their future were only using me. He did not realize that. I now felt that those psychic powers may help us look into the past or see what might be in the future. They do not help us free ourselves from our human condition. I was feeling that there was a growing split in my consciousness and that it was creating a conflict within me. I kept this knowledge to myself and told no one. As the magician, right?
Mm-hmm.
If I had, the center's future might have been different if he had told people. So he says, I called a meeting of the inner group and suggested that we should incorporate the center as a non-profit organization in the state of Washington. Now, were you saying that he might have been thinking that before he left Grace?
Yeah.
Okay.
But go ahead.
But now he's left her, and it's been going on for a while. He says, after some talk and a decision to go ahead, I wanted to formally rename the center as the Center of Integration, East-West Studies.
Well, what may have happened is he may have gotten an incorporation, but then reincorporated with new bylaws.
New nonprofit.
Yeah, different setup.
Do you remember the title, East-West Studies?
Oh, yeah, I think so, but I don't know whether I ever paid much attention to it. That was what went on there.
Yes.
And so it's being in the title was, you know.
It might have been in the corporate papers. You don't remember.
I don't remember. Yes. What I remember is the denotations. The founder had the right to do this, that, the other. And
right, that's what he says here. And he's going to mention a name of someone we've talked about. So he says, at this meeting, he wanted to formally rename the center as the Center of Integration, East-West Studies. After I explained my ideas, we voted to go ahead. I wanted to remain in the background, but have a seat on the board of trustees. So he had a seat on the board. That's the controlling factor.
Yeah.
And he's in the background kind of controlling.
Okay.
Is that what you're saying when
he was the founder.
He was the founder.
He had a position as the founder. Now,
he's not
go
saying,
ahead.
He's just saying that he's just one of the trustees here.
Well.
But when I read this, I got that vibe, that the way he's in the background, that he would be a level above and controlling. But that was just an intuition.
But as the founder, the way it's written up, he had the hammer.
So, yeah, and he...
No matter what the board said or anything else, he had the hammer in this situation, because that's what it had to be, so he wouldn't have a repeat of that and that and that.
Right. And he's the one who suggests the whole change, and they all agree with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then he says Dr. John Noyes was voted president.
Yeah, he was the president before me.
And we've talked about him. He said,
yeah, he was the one,
He says, John, what? Go ahead.
He's the one in his first acid session was holding a lemon seed, and somebody walked up and said, what are you doing, John? He says, well, I'm thinking as a physicist all that I know, but this gives life. He's the one who went on to become the astrophysicist for NASA, the first one.
Right. It says here, John had a degree in physics and headed the Boeing space program. Is NASA
well,
later?
Whatever they say.
Yeah, well, he's talking
that
about...
That might have peaked before...
That was before. He went from Boeing to NASA.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's the Boeing space program. I think he's mixing it up here because...
Possibly.
Why would Boeing have a space program in 54?
They did, but I'm not sure they had one then.
Right. Yeah. And okay, so that may be a merging of various factors in Bob's memory.
Yeah, he was at Boeing, and then the guy later went to NASA, and of course Boeing had did a lot about building stuff for space.
Well, I can't see them having space as a program in 55. Sputnik doesn't happen until 57. And then NASA's formed in 58.
Yeah, but, 58. In 1960, down in Oakland, California, we saw John and Vernetta. And he was getting ready to take flights to view the solar eclipse in the South Pacific from a plane for NASA.
For NASA, 1960, right. And it's just that, I mean, the Boeing, were they thinking of space in 55? It must have been secret if they were.
Well, it's possible, but it's possible that he was a physicist at Boeing, and then later he got involved with space, so Bob may have put it together that way, but I don't know, you know, it's like it would take some checking to find out whether Boeing was doing space work at that time or not.
Right. Now, did you...
That's unimportant. The
right.
point is, John Noyes was a physicist, and he was the president of the Center of Integration before I was.
Right. And the point is, this was a guy who would have eventually have CIA liaison in the position he was in. He did astrophysics for NASA. Was he the main guy, or just one of many scientists?
He was... The fifth in other words, in NASA, he was the fifth from the top. He had the ranking of number five.
Yeah, now that's pretty...
From the top NASA down, so he was number five, but he was the astrophysicist for a time.
And what's amazing is that people would be watching John Glenn and the space rockets going up in 62-63, and one of the top guys had been doing acid with Dave Worster 6 years before. See, you put it together. Put it together, people. Are you seeing the point here?
Well, you consider all the different people that were in those sessions. There were 75 people in those sessions over the 3 years. And if you look into the histories of all those, the things they went to, there was some pretty incredible stuff.
And on top of the just Captain Hubbard and the CIA guys on top of the, in there.
Well, they were the ones that brought it.
Okay. It says Phyllis and Marie, Phyllis Goodall, Marie Hawk remained on the board. Were they on the board? They were gone when you got there, right?
Not necessarily. I saw them a lot, and I assume they were still on the board.
Oh, but she had moved out. Phyllis had moved out. That's what I'm thinking.
You're talking about living there. Yeah. But I saw her often, and she's the one who pulled out Casey Folder and says, yeah, I was there when this was taken down, etc. And I said, see, it's like, so what? I didn't, everybody knows about Casey, but I didn't know about Casey. As a matter of fact, at that point, not very many people did.
You're right, yeah.
It was only later that, but here was somebody who was able to relate to that energy then, and to relate to Bob's energy then, and then relate to other things that happened. So she had a lot of perception and connection on that level. That's sure.
We're talking Phyllis, and what about Marie Hawk?
Marie Hawk, I don't remember for sure. I remember she...
You remember the name?
Yeah, I think that's the woman who was kind of like the caretaker of the house.
Right.
When you were there.
Yeah.
That she was present. She was a quiet woman. She had big glasses, thick glasses, and but she seemed to acquiesce to, all Bob would have to do was just tell her something and she'd take care of it. And
well, she's
so there wasn't even that much conversation sometimes with her.
She was listed as a treasurer.
Uh-huh.
She used, originally, when they set it up, she was the treasurer.
Uh-huh.
So that's a chartered accountant. That's money stuff. That's boring. No one's going to talk to her, right?
Well, I guess.
Okay, do you remember, did Phyllis take LSD?
I'm pretty sure she did, but not necessarily when I don't remember being in a session with her.
Okay. All right. That's good enough.
But that was later time.
Right. So Phyllis and Marie remained on the board. Within weeks, we received our legal papers and we're now in an accredited organization. The Center.
Did it say the date?
No, but this is 55, I would say.
Uh-huh.
We need to look up the date of the First and Last Freedom because that starts this whole chapter, is the date of that book.
Well, yeah, I know, but and he gave it to me in 57.
But see, this is a new book. It's First and Last Freedom. In my mind, it comes out in 55. That's just a little fragment of memory. I don't know if I'm right. I think I looked it up at one point 25 years ago and it stuck in my brain. But because it was a key book for the popularization of Krishnamurti.
Yes. The other set was his three volumes of commentaries on living.
Yes, yeah.
So those were very famous.
Yeah. And they came out after First and Last Freedom.
I think so.
Yeah. Okay, they were an accredited...
I think they're published by Harper's, but I'm not sure.
So I would say this is 54, into 55, somewhere like that. Okay, I mean, I could wiki maybe Krishnamurti and check the date, but let's just hold it now. They were now an accredited organization. The center provided a platform for visiting teachers of Eastern thought and for studies in Western psychology. Now, this is what's an interesting statement. This was the first organization of its kind in the Northwest, and we pioneered what later became a trend in the late 60s.
Mm-hmm.
That's the important. I mean, they were the first.
It's even more than the Northwest. Ultimately, it was probably the most prominent thing of its sort in the world. I mean, other than Russia, but we heard things from Russia. Probably came from the CIA.
Right, but the thing is, Alan Watts was talking about East and West studies in the early 60s, but this is an institution in the middle 50s. And it's...
Oh, he was doing that down there, East and West studies.
Right,
for quite a while.
But that's in the... Well, yeah, maybe it's in the same time, but this is a center, and it's like it's like Esalen 10 years before.
Yeah.
Exactly. So that's what he means here. He's saying it was the first organization of its kind in the Northwest. Yeah, maybe it was somewhere else, but they pioneered.
I think the Esalen came afterwards anyway.
Oh, yeah, Esalen comes in 62, 63.
Because I used to go down there where the Esalen eventually formed. I used to go down there to the baths, and it was a gay baths with and Big Sur with all kinds of people coming and going. And then somewhere along the line, somebody decided to have a seminar, and it became so popular that others did seminars, and pretty soon they thought they'd string these seminars together into Esalen.
Right. Okay, so... he's saying we pioneered what later became a trend in the late 60s. It's the East-West aspect, plus the psychic stuff and everything. It was the first New Age center, so to speak, in the post-60s sense, where people had a global culture and were doing East-West and everything.
Pre-60s.
These pre-60s, but what becomes in the late 60s, early 70s, New Age centers, they're global New Age centers. They do things from all over the planet. But he was doing that.
Yeah, well, by the time the Summer of Love occurred, Alan Watts and Bob and Connie and a doctor and a psychiatrist formed a free clinic right in the heart of Haight Ashbury to take people on bum trips through and out.
About that doctor who, he had a column in the Underground Papers, I remember his name. But you're saying Bob would help set up that free clinic?
Yeah, Bob and Connie and this doctor they knew and a psychiatrist and Alan Watts. And Alan Watts is the one who told the hippies to stop being so grungy, get yourself some colorful clothes and be pretty.
Ah.
And they did
for
a time.
That's interesting. Okay, I was just going to look up something if you kept talking, but let's carry. We can do that maybe another time, get the name of that doctor. Okay, so he says, the center began to have a life of its own. There was no formal membership, nothing to join. People could come and go as they liked, and if they wanted to support the activities, that was a matter of their choice. So that's pretty cool, right?
Mm-hmm.
One Sunday evening. Are you moving around? Are you moving around making... Yeah, okay. You're uncomfortable?
Well, I just twitching.
Okay. Well, this will make you twitch. One Sunday evening, I noticed a new face in the room. A younger man in his mid-20s. For the next several weeks, I watched him. After one of the talks, he stayed on in the library. So I asked him how he came to know about the center. He introduced himself as Conrad Keeler and told me that a friend from his work informed him about the center.
That's bullshit. But it's nice entree. Go ahead.
Yeah, he says, I invited him for coffee. He seemed unusual, as it was very uncommon for anyone younger than 40 to be interested in this sort of thing. He talks about that. It's mostly older people around this whole center world, this East-West psychology world.
At that time.
Yeah. So, he says, during the next few weeks, Conrad came to all the talks, and we often went out to have coffee. We talked for hours. Right away, there was a connection between us that was deeper than one has with most people. He was very intelligent, though he had never been to college. He had married when he was just 19, and the marriage hadn't lasted long. He was depressed and did not want to live. His sister Vivian, who you mentioned earlier, right? Sister Vivian, did you? Yeah, you mentioned her. His sister Vivian, who was older, helped him in his depression. They were quite close. He had gone
She was gay.
Okay. They were quite close. He had gone into the army to get his life in order. But he had been lucky. He didn't have to serve overseas in Korea. You remember that? That he didn't have to serve overseas?
I knew he was in the Army, but I couldn't remember the details about that.
Instead, he stayed on the base in California and had worked in the supplies department. Reminds me of Paul Seibel. Remember Paul went to Vietnam, but he just worked in the supplies or something? He didn't have to go to battle?
I don't know. I never questioned what Paul did. He told me about a lot of things where he did work in supplies and etc., but as to whether he had any other activities that took him out into the field, we just never talked about it. So I figured if there was something, he just didn't want to talk about it.
Oh, okay, so maybe he did do it, but he just doesn't talk about it.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I just have this vague memory of him in like what they call that, the procurement, the there's a word for the
supply. Well, I think he was an MP.
Yeah, maybe that's what he was. That sounds familiar. Okay. But so my memory is that it wasn't violent. He didn't have to deal with the shooting too much. So that was lucky. Anyway, he stayed on the base. Connie stayed on the base in California and had worked in the supplies department. When he was discharged, he returned to Seattle. He was confused and was looking for some direction. Our meeting and getting to know each other changed his life and turned him around completely.
The first night.
With Ken. Ken didn't get him. It was a battle with Ken over Connie.
Well, I think it would have been, because it was the first time Connie had come to that place too, and he saw Bob, didn't pay much to Ken, but he saw, I've got to know this guy. And
who said that? Who said, I've got to know this guy?
Connie.
He told me that.
He told me, I looked up and I saw this guy, and I said, I've got to know this guy. And I said, here, I'm on the other side of the room saying, I don't want to know this guy. We laughed about it.
What year is that when you're having that conversation?
Well, that would have been before I went to the center.
No, Connie. And we were talking about, when are you having this conversation with Connie?
Oh. It could have been over the years. It could have been fairly soon or...
But you're saying that you...
Because I didn't even know that Connie was there. So it was later that I found out that he was there, that I was there, and all this, and I thought... And you're saying, I got to meet this guy, and I say, I got to not meet this guy.
but you had met Bob. You're saying that this is after you met Bob, you had reservations about Bob? Is that what you're saying?
After I saw him there at Reinhardt's, I certainly did.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that. That's right.
I refused to go for a long time until Claire got me to go to a dinner, and then I heard him, and then I changed my mind. I wanted to talk to him.
All right.
And then when I talked to him, then he opened the door to the place, and so on and so on.
Yeah, I forgot. I totally forgot that. So you're the setting here is that you and Connie go to Keith Reinhardt's place. That's how this is the first night. You go to Keith Reinhardt's place, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you've been asked to go there by who?
Claire.
Oh, Claire Olson, right.
I think.
Yeah, Claire, I think I met her in 69, 70. She had done acid. She might have been in her 60s then. Does that sound right for Claire? She was quite old.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure because
she had an old beaten-up coat on in 70 when I met her.
Oh, you're talking about somebody else.
Another Claire?
No, because E. Claire Olson was a furrier. She was a...
Oh, okay, this is E. Claire.
I. Claire,
oh,
yeah.
Oh, you're saying E. Claire. Okay. Anyways, the thing is that E. Claire takes you to this place...
I think her initials were E. and Claire.
Right.
But E. Claire Olson.
Esther Claire, say. Evelyn Claire. Eber or something. But you're saying that you go to this Ed Reinhardt's center... Or not Ed Reinhardt, Ken Reinhardt Center, okay? And you're there, and you don't know until years later that Connie is there. And then Bob gives a talk about, what, seeing auras? What did you say?
He just read auras. In other words, he asked him to come up and read auras. So he just come up there, and then he read auras.
Well, that's funny. And you say, I don't want to know this guy. And Connie says, I got to know this
another
guy.
Nut.
And this is maybe 56? This is a year before you...
Well, it could be late 50. See, the haunted house was in September 56.
And this was... Just, going
the
in
connection system. With Claire was probably within the next month.
Oh, you meet
so.
Her after, you meet her after the haunted house?
Yeah, when we started going around... to spiritualist churches, and all these biddies wanted us to form a whole new church, and we wouldn't have anything to do with it. So anyway, at one point, I needed... Chris went to Everett, Cecil went working in a hotel, and I went to stay in a house that Claire had, which was a big house that she rented to students, and so I became a renter with her. And we talked and talked and talked and talked for days and days and nights and nights and nights. I was really running, and she was getting the idea, and so anyway, she's the one who deflected me to Reinhardt and then tried to get me to go to see Carr, and finally I did. I don't know what that date was, but I don't think it was a holiday, because I don't recall that the dinner was like a Thanksgiving or a Christmas, so it could have been anywhere in between there.
So maybe October.
I'd be comfortable with that, and then that would allow enough time for me to be there for a while before the acid trip happened, because in the meantime, in the early part of 57, I was working for Pacific Engineers. The partners sued each other, so I had 3 weeks off while they did that, and during that time was when Chris and Cecil leased the restaurant in the Paramount Theater building, and they needed to have the remodeling done, and so in this 3 weeks I had off, I did the remodeling of the place, and then as it got ready to open, Cease disappeared with the money and all the jobbers and the groceries and everything else was arriving, and so I just paid them, and so I became a partner without intending to be. So that was I can say that probably because see that restaurant figures into the LSD.
Yeah,
because it was there that this guy brought the Doors of Perception and then invited me to a party on Friday night. And I don't know what that date was, but it would have probably been in the spring of 57.
That what happened?
As a matter of fact, I think that's the closest I've come to coming up with a date for a long time.
What happened in the spring? Which event?
That I was working for this thing and then had the time and they needed to have the remodeling, and then as a fluke because of Cease, then I became a partner in that restaurant. And I was in that restaurant when the invitation to LSD occurred.
And you're thinking now that seems like the spring of 57.
Yes, it does seem like it. I suppose we could even look it up in data. In other words, whenever they got the lease on that restaurant, it would be in within the following month, probably.
Okay. Now, it's interesting. You mentioned Chris went off to Everett before they get back into Seattle for the restaurant, and that's where you're now. You're in Everett talking
Yeah. Right? I say he had gone to Everett, and I'm talking from Everett. I didn't say he came up here. Because I was back in time of being in Seattle talking about Everett.
Yeah, back to the future. So you're saying that he went up to Everett and then came back to Seattle, and that's when the restaurant started, right? I got that right?
Yeah.
Okay, so what you're saying, though, at this party in October, November, when they go to Ken Reinhardt's place, Connie's there, he's impressed with Bob, you're not, but you know as a fact that Bob took him home that night.
Not until later. I didn't know then.
You didn't. Yes, I mean, you found out later that Connie and Bob went home that night.
Yes.
The night that you didn't have any interest in Bob.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's not what's being said here in this book.
No, I know.
He's still...
It's all right.
Still,
it's all right.
He's still... No, he's still denying he's gay.
I don't know. It's his smooth way of introducing him into the narrative, and it's all right.
Yeah, the back of the book has a statement by a famous Indian film director who became a friend of Bob Carr's 20 or more years ago through this anti-Krishnamurti, U.G. Krishnamurti. But the thing is that this guy, director Mahesh Bhatt, says that this book is a grenade thrown into the spiritual marketplace. Taking that idea, he is talking to a spiritual audience, quote, spiritual audience, so he's probably not emphasizing the,
right,
the you know, whatever.
In other words, he's including it, but he's tempering it. Yeah.
Yeah, because of the kind of audience that would read this book, or trying to be virtuous or spiritual or something. And
yeah.
So
like
that's
his naming the Keith Richards.
Yes. Okay. So I'm thinking that we need to stop. Could you do this tomorrow? Just take a pause here for a second. No. Just take a pause, Dave.
Yeah.
So Scott stops it. Okay, Scott, you around? Scott probably fell asleep. Hey!